Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, November 30th, 2022. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. Starting on today's front page, our first headline reads, Linn County Republican, recount to put auditor on notice. Wynocht versus Wilson among three Iowa House races contested. By Tom Barton of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. A recount in a close Linn County State House race is being done this week out of optics and to put the Democratic County Auditor on notice, that's in quotes, over an error, since corrected, in the reporting of its early vote counts, according to the Republican member appointed to the recount board. A bipartisan three-member board began recounting ballots Tuesday in Iowa House District 73, one of three legislative races being recounted statewide, where Democrats won in the November 8th elections, according to unofficial results. Republican Susie Wynocht, a former Cedar Rapids City Council member, asked for a recount in the State House race where she trails Democrat Elizabeth Wilson by about 300 votes for an open seat, according to unofficial results. Because the race's margin was more than 1% of the total number of votes counted, Wynocht paid a $150 bond to the Iowa Secretary of State's office. According to the most recent totals, 14,292 votes were cast in the House District 73 race. The bond, however, does not cover the cost of county staff time to run tabulators and scanners, oversee the security of the ballots, and otherwise facilitate the recount, a cost that will be picked up by taxpayers and depend on how quickly the recount is completed, said Matt Warfield, Linn County Deputy Commissioner of Elections. Under Iowa law, the recount board, which includes a representative chosen by each candidate and a third mutually chosen representative, can determine whether it wants to do a hand recount, machine recount, or both. A hand recount would allow the board to gauge intent if a voter failed to properly mark the ballot, but would be time-consuming and involve roughly 45,000 ballots, Warfield said. That includes sorting through some 28,700 absentee ballots again to determine which early voters cast a ballot in that state house race. Warfield estimated a machine recount could be completed within 3 days, but a hand recount could take up to 98 hours and likely could not be completed by a state-imposed deadline of Monday. James Conklin of Marion, a former chair of the Linn County Republican Party Central Committee, who was appointed by Wynocht, pushed for a hand recount and urged the board to ignore the statutory deadline and possible legal repercussions. Conklin said he did not expect to find enough votes to overturn the results, but that's not the reason. He cited, quote, shenanigans, unquote, on Election Day by the Linn County Auditor's Office, including erroneously leaving an election for a county supervisor off the ballot in one precinct and an error reporting its early vote counts. Absent a post-election audit of the race, which a recount is not, Conklin, who repeatedly said he had no evidence of impropriety by the Linn County Auditor's Office, argued a hand recount was necessary to hold Auditor Joel Miller and his office accountable. We can't audit any of the process, but at least we can put the Auditor's Office and some of their people on notice that if there's that many shenanigans, we are going to do everything we can legally to make sure we look at this stuff, Conklin said. Miller, a Democrat who unsuccessfully ran against Republican Secretary of State Paul Pate in the November 8th election, did not respond to a message seeking comment Tuesday afternoon. Conklin said the recount was delayed due to objections and disagreements between him and Linda Langston, a former Linn County supervisor appointed by Wilson, over who to select as a third member. Both Conklin and Langston eventually chose Cedar Rapids lawyer Frank Mitvalsky. In the end, Langston and Mitvalsky voted to conduct a machine recount. Both said they were not opposed to a hand recount, but were worried about the board being able to meet the deadline. The real reason people are pushing for this recount is because of the optics of that night, Conklin said. So when we're done, if all we do is a machine count, I'm all for that, but I'm going to make sure people understand it was done for expediency. According to the Linn County Auditor's Office, a computer froze while the county's absentee ballot counts were being uploaded on election night. The process was completed on a backup computer, but officials believe 600 ballots were inadvertently reported twice. The discrepancy was discovered by the Iowa Secretary of State's office, which alerted the Linn County Auditor's Office. The Auditor's Office resolved it, and the posted results were corrected. But as a result, the unofficial results of the House District 73 election shifted from showing Wynocht in the lead on election night to Wilson winning by about 300 votes. It doesn't smell right to people, Conklin said. Similar issues occurred in Scott County, where 47 voters in a Davenport precinct were given the wrong ballots, and a discrepancy of nearly 500 absentee ballots found in the tallies on election night led to a week of administrative recounts of the county's absentee ballots. Scott County has a Republican auditor. On election night, Republican Luanna Stoltenberg appeared to be ahead by 29 votes in House District 81, but after the administrative recounts, Democrat Craig Cooper took the lead by 6 votes. Stoltenberg requested a recount, which was also scheduled to begin Tuesday. Also, Republican Doug Campbell requested a recount in District 49 in Cerro Gordo County, where he trails Democrat Sharon Steckman. The Iowa Secretary of State's office said it planned to send letters of inquiry to both Linn County and Scott County auditors, and has been in touch with both the Linn County and Scott County attorneys and Iowa Attorney General's office. However, as of Tuesday afternoon, the letters had not been sent, a spokesman for the Iowa Secretary of State said. Joel Miller and I have not always agreed, Langston said, but I don't have any issues with the office and the people who work here and their desire to do a good job. Also on today's front page, UI will see construction boom in 2023. Work will pave the way for a new inpatient tower in 2025, by Vanessa Miller. Construction of a University of Iowa inpatient tower on its main medical campus, first unveiled in January as part of a 10-year master plan, is expected to start just 2 years in 2025. And in 2023, the UI will kickstart hundreds of millions of dollars in construction to either enable that massive project or propel a West Campus transformation for expanded healthcare access, increased academic opportunities, and amplified athletic experiences. It's an exciting time to be a Hawkeye and to witness the campus transformation that will take place beginning in 2023, according to a UI summary of the work to ensue. Projects will include state-of-the-art buildings, equipment, learning spaces, and other amenities. Crews will begin or continue work on a new parking ramp, a larger water tower, a new West Campus academic building, a renovated pharmaceutical sciences research building, the inpatient addition in the UI Hospital South Wing, and an expanded emergency room. UI Hospitals and Clinics also is planning a $95 million vertical expansion of its existing main campus inpatient tower, adding 2 floors, 24 intensive care unit beds, and more patient space on renovated floors below. The university plans to finish that vertical expansion in 2025, just as it starts building the new tower. Although officials haven't yet sought State Board of Regents design or budget approval, they recently revealed, through a facilities master plan, expectations to spend $620.9 million on the new tower over the next 5 budget years. The tower will add more beds for UI Hospitals and Clinics, which is consistently at or above capacity, or according to the UI summary. The additional space will significantly improve operations and help the hospital to continue providing access and care for complex patients who come from every county in Iowa. Officials warned all the construction could cause some short-term disruption for students, faculty, staff, patients, and visitors. As with any major construction project, we will put a high priority on minimizing the impact for our campus community, patients, and visitors, Rod Leonards, Senior Vice President for Finance and Operations and University Architect, said in a statement. These temporary inconveniences are enabling an exciting campus transformation that will benefit generations to come. The West Campus construction comes in addition to massive projects UIHC is pursuing off its main campus, such as the $525.6 million hospital campus in North Liberty at Forever Green Road and Highway 965. That project is expected to wrap in 2025, alongside many of the enabling and transformative West Side projects. Projects upcoming or in the works include a $65 million Hawkeye ramp just north of Kinnick Stadium on Lot 43 will connect to the existing hospital skywalk and add about 900 parking spaces, serving primarily university faculty and staff working on the hospital campus. Construction is expected to begin in May and finish in winter 2024. A new West Campus academic building will house UI's Wendell Johnson Speech and Hearing Center and its Communication Sciences and Disorders program, along with the campus health and human physiology and physical therapy programs. Construction on the site of the existing South Quad Residence Hall and adjacent parking lot is expected to start in summer 2023 and wrap in 2025. The university is renovating its Pharmaceutical Sciences Research Building to become the new home of Iowa's Military Science and ROTC program, with completion expected in spring 2023. That recently went out for bid for $2 million. A $24.6 million emergency room renovation and expansion would be in two phases. Construction on its north side begins in February and wraps in November 2024. Work on its south side would start in May and finish in April 2024. The $95 million vertical expansion of UIHC's existing inpatient tower is in the planning phases with expectations of completion in 2025. An $8 million project to convert the second level of UIHC's south wing into 13 inpatient rooms is being planned, with construction expected to start in spring 2023. UIHC also wants to spend $2.3 million building a new ophthalmology simulation lab on a lower level of its parking ramp 4, renovating storage space for a wet lab where students could conduct dissections and other simulated surgical procedures. And UI has aired plans to spend $212 million over the next 5 years on a new modern healthcare research facility scheduled to start in 2024 and end in 2027. To make all that happen, among other things, UI over the next 5 years plans to raise 300,000 square feet of dated or defunct space, including its hospital parking ramp 1, current Wendell Johnson Speech and Hearing Center, and the South Quad dorms. The university has taken down 200,000 square feet over the last 3 years in trying to right-size its campus. Decision nears on fate of Iowa caucuses. DNC committee expected to decide this week who gets early dates on its presidential nominating calendar by Caleb McCullough of the Gazette Lee Des Moines Bureau. Iowa's future is the first state where Democrats cast their preference for president will likely be decided this week. The Democratic National Committee's Rules and Bylaws Committee will meet Thursday through Saturday in Washington, D.C., and the committee is expected to vote on the party's presidential nominating calendar, potentially knocking Iowa off the first-in-the-nation spot it has held for half a century. The committee will make a recommendation to the full DNC at the party's next meeting. While a vote on the calendar is expected to come up, Scott Brennan, an Iowan who sits on the Rules Committee, said the Rules Committee has not yet received an agenda for this week's meeting. Iowa's caucuses have led the pack in presidential preference contests for both parties since 1972, drawing media attention and millions of dollars in campaigning. This year, the National Democrats Rules Committee voted to open up the early window, requiring states to apply if they want to hold a presidential primary or caucus before the first Tuesday in March. The current early states are Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina. Iowa is among 16 states and Puerto Rico that applied this summer to be in the early window. The DNC will select up to 5 states that will be allowed to hold contests early. The Rules Committee said it would favor states that are diverse, competitive in the general election, and can run transparent and accessible contests. Iowa is around 85% white and has been trending increasingly Republican in recent elections. Iowa Democratic Party Chair Ross Wilburn, who will attend the Rules Committee meeting, said in an email statement Tuesday that Iowa would allow rural representation and an even playing field for candidates seeking the presidential nomination. It is clearer than ever that D.C. Democrats cannot forget about entire groups of voters in the heart of the Midwest without doing significant damage to the party for a generation, he said. Iowa is also the only Midwest state under consideration that can back up the claim that we are an inexpensive opportunity to lesser-known candidates who do not have immediate name recognition. Wilburn noted Iowa's media markets are cheaper than those in Minnesota and Michigan, which also applied to hold early contests, and the state offers campaigns access to urban, suburban, and rural voters. Most Iowans agree that the caucuses should remain first, according to a Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll from October. According to the poll, 53% of Iowans said it would be best if Iowa goes first, while 26% said it would be best if another state goes first, and 21% were not sure. Calls to remove Iowa's first-in-the-nation status intensified after the 2020 caucuses when administrative issues and a malfunctioning app led to a delay in results. Fired Tyson supervisors say they deserve bonuses. Company says some of them were involved in COVID-19 betting pool. By Jeff Reinitz of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. A Tyson Fresh Meats manager accused of arranging a COVID-19 office pool and encouraging interpreters to mislead workers about the coronavirus pandemic, is taking the meatpacking company to court, asserting he was not paid a bonus he was entitled to when he was fired. Thomas Hart, who is manager at the Waterloo plant at the onset of the 2020 coronavirus outbreak, filed a suit seeking $125,000 in unpaid annual incentive plan compensation in Blackhawk County District Court in October. Other supervisory employees who, like Hart, are named as defendants in wrongful death suits brought by the estates of Tyson workers who died of COVID-19 also are crying foul for missing bonuses. In court records, Tyson said it withheld bonuses, in at least some cases, because of allegations the managers took part in the office pool. According to Hart's suit, he was hired by the company in 1994 and the bonuses were included in addition to his biweekly salary. On November 18, 2020, Hart was told he would be getting $125,000 in incentive pay. He was suspended the following day and discharged from the company on December 15, 2020, without receiving the bonus, the suit states. His attorneys, Nathaniel R. Bolton and Marlon Moorman of Des Moines, assert the company withheld his wages in violation of Iowa statutes. Hart also is named as a defendant in lawsuits over the COVID-19 outbreak at Tyson. The suits allege he organized a winner-take-all betting pool for Tyson supervisors and managers to wager on how many employees would test positive for COVID-19. This occurred while public officials were calling for the plant to be closed for safety reasons. Among other things, Hart and others allegedly directed interpreters to tell non-English-speaking employees that everything is fine and that there was no outbreak at the plant, and to tell them there were no confirmed cases and the health department had cleared the plant of COVID-19, according to the wrongful death suits. Another former Tyson manager who is taking the company to court over unpaid bonuses is Brett Tapkin. He had worked at the plant since 1994 and was utility room superintendent. He is seeking $14,500 in withheld bonus pay. Prosecutors drop manslaughter charge in fatal CR shooting. Prosecutors say stand your ground law was determining factor, by Trish Mahaffey. A Cedar Rapids man who faced a voluntary manslaughter charge for fatally shooting another man during a fight is free after the charge was dropped by the Linn County Attorney's Office. Assistant Linn County Attorney Molly Edwards, in a motion filed earlier this month, asked a judge to dismiss the charge against James Siegel, 42, based on Iowa stand your ground law, and said there is insufficient evidence to prove the manslaughter charge. Siegel initially was charged with first-degree murder, but a few weeks later it was amended to voluntary manslaughter for the fatal shooting of Ty John Casey, 39, on May 13th in northeast Cedar Rapids. At that time, additional investigation revealed a history between the two men, and the crime scene and autopsy supported the lesser charge, according to the amended complaint. Siegel's actions resulted from a sudden, violent, and irresistible passion as a result of serious provocation, elements of voluntary manslaughter by Casey, the amended complaint stated. Linn County Attorney Nick Maybanks at that time was asked about the history between Siegel and Casey, but he said he couldn't provide details. On Tuesday, Maybanks told the Gazette that once the investigation was completed, he and Edwards, along with Cedar Rapids police investigators, evaluated the case and agreed there wasn't the necessary evidence to prove voluntary manslaughter beyond a reasonable doubt. The investigation revealed that the stand your ground law was the determining factor, Maybanks said. Our office strives to act with the utmost integrity, and one of the core principles of prosecutors is to only pursue cases for which we have the evidence to convict. The Iowa Stand Your Ground law regarding the justifiable use of deadly force allows for a presumption that deadly force is reasonable when another person enters their dwelling unlawfully if a person believes they are in danger of injury, Maybanks said. That is not a presumption we could overcome in this case based on the investigation of the crime scene, statements, and the history between the parties. Casey's family was advised of the decision to dismiss the charge before the motion was filed and approved by the court. Out of respect for the family, we have no further comment at this time, Maybanks said. The Stand Your Ground law was amended in 2017 to require that the person using deadly force against another should notify or have another person notify law enforcement about the incident within a reasonable period of time. According to the complaint, Siegel did call 911 at 9 p.m. May 13th to report a shooting at his home, 3906 Northwood Drive Northeast. He told dispatchers he shot Casey. Officials found Casey with a gunshot wound and he died at the scene. There was another person, not identified in the complaint, in the home at the time who was taken, along with Siegel, to the police department for questioning, according to the complaint. Siegel told investigators Casey threw a glancing punch at him and Siegel responded by picking up a Ruger handgun from a nightstand and firing a shot that hit Casey in the upper chest area, the complaint stated. Casey threw another punch at Siegel and missed. Then Siegel shot a second time at Casey at point-blank range, and then fired one more time, hitting Casey in the back, according to the complaint. Siegel was a newsroom clerk for the Gazette for nearly 7 years, leaving the company in early 2007. Iowa DOT to hold public hearing on Interstate 380 widening project. Virtual in-person options available for today's meeting, by Marissa Payne. The Iowa Department of Transportation will hold a public hearing from 5 to 6 p.m. today on its project to widen Interstate 380 and rebuild the interchange with Wright Brothers Boulevard. The meeting will be in Conference Room A at the Iowa DOT's District 6 office, 5455 Kirkwood Boulevard Southwest in Cedar Rapids. The interstate changes will affect I-380 from north of Johnson County Road F-12, 120th Street, to south of U.S. 30, while reconfiguring the Wright Brothers Boulevard interchange, the main exit to the Eastern Iowa Airport and a rapidly growing area, fueled by a boom in manufacturing, warehouses, and homes. According to the DOT, the meeting will focus on showing the impacts to adjacent property. Iowa DOT staff will be prepared to informally discuss the proposed improvements, but there will be no formal presentation. There also is a virtual presentation that people can attend between today and December 8th. To do so, navigate to iowadot.gov/PIM and click on I-380 Public Meeting Number 4. The Iowa DOT must receive all comments on the proposed projects by December 8th to be considered. Comments may be directed to Kathy Cutler, Transportation Planner at the Iowa DOT District 6 office. Omaha man arrested in IC for burglary. Also faces other charges, by Emily Anderson. A Nebraska man was arrested in Iowa City last week on charges that he threatened a man with a gun and punched him inside his vehicle. Timothy McGuire, 41, of Omaha, is charged with first-degree burglary, intimidation with a dangerous weapon, and going armed with intent, all felonies. He also is facing misdemeanor charges of assault while displaying a dangerous weapon, possessing a dangerous weapon while under the influence, person ineligible to carry a dangerous weapon, and operating under the influence. According to a criminal complaint, McGuire was looking for a friend's cell phone Friday evening and tracked it to the 400 block of Kirkwood Avenue. He approached a man who was sitting in a car and accused him of stealing the phone. McGuire reached into the vehicle and punched the man, causing injuries to the man's head and stomach, then pulled out a gun and pointed it at the man, while continuing to accuse him of stealing the phone. McGuire eventually left in a white truck and was stopped by police shortly afterward. When he was arrested, he was intoxicated, the criminal complaint states. After spending the weekend in the Johnson County Jail, McGuire was released on a $32,000 surety bond Monday morning. He has his first appearance in court on Tuesday. North Liberty Fire Department expands to keep up with growth. Second station has to be in the right spot for decades to come, Fire Chief says, by Isabella Zaluska. The North Liberty Fire Department is recruiting 3 full-time firefighters while also pursuing a location for a second fire station as the city grows and faces an increased number of calls for help. The full-time firefighters and additional station would help reduce response times, address rising call volumes, and prepare the department for the coming years. The North Liberty Department's call volume already is outpacing Fire Chief Brian Platz's predictions. He was hired in 2017 as the department's first full-time chief. The department's call volume last year was 1,648 calls. So far this year, firefighters have responded to just under 1,400 calls through October. Platz said October alone had roughly 180 calls, a record month for the department. It seems like every day we have conversations about trying to anticipate the next issue or the next benchmark, Platz said. I have to keep being reminded it's okay to stop and look around a little bit and realize where we came from and all the progress that we've been able to make in the last 5 years. In order to meet the needs of residents, the department and city decided the second fire station should be located along St. Andrews Drive. This area on the southwest side of town will see increased activity with the new University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics campus and events at Centennial Park. The station has to be in the right spot for decades to come, and that's not lost on us, Platz said, adding that the department is trying to stay ahead of the growth in that area. The City Council is expected to hear an update on potential sites for the second station in December. North Liberty's fire department has evolved and grown in the 5 years since Platz was hired. When he started, there were 3 paid staff members and about 25 to 30 paid per call volunteer firefighters. Now the department is a combination of about 19 paid staff members, ranging from full-time to part-time, along with 33 paid per call firefighters, Platt said. We're just so fortunate to have Chief Platts on board, City Administrator Ryan Heyer said. What he has done for our department has just been phenomenal, and we're happy to have him here as a resource. After Platts was hired, a staffing plan was put together based on call volume, the city's growth and development, and turnover. That plan indicated the department would have to start hiring full-time firefighters in fiscal 2023, which is the current fiscal year. It also was important for Platts to create a positive and healthy culture in the fire department. Nobody wants to volunteer their time or hang out at a place where they're not appreciated or it's not fun to be a part of, Platts said. One of the things we really worked hard on, and it's something that takes work every day, is creating a culture and creating an environment where people want to belong. The department is actively recruiting for 3 full-time firefighters thanks to a $1 million grant from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. The funds will be received over 3 years. There were a couple of factors signaling the need to hire full-time firefighters, Platt said. The department was seeing its volunteer firefighters leaving after 3 to 5 years, as well as feeling burnout due to high call volumes. We were lucky enough to get selected, which tells me that if we were selected and awarded that grant, the folks reading the grant saw the need, Platt said. Each of the 3 new firefighters will work a 24-hour schedule and then be off for 48 hours. This will allow the city to always have 1 full-time firefighter on duty. The full-time firefighter on duty will help supervise 2 part-time firefighters, creating a 3-person crew every night. The 3 new firefighters will be stationed at the current fire station for the foreseeable future, Platt said. The fire department and city use strategic planning, response time analysis, and other data to help inform the location of a second station. The research indicated that the next station should be along St. Andrews Drive. Platt said this location will allow the department to respond quicker to the increased calls from the south and west parts of town, as well as stay ahead of the growth expected in this area. The location will cut many critical travel times in half, according to the city. Being located along St. Andrews would also allow the second station to assist the main station on West Cherry Street, Platt said. Last year, more than a quarter of the time the station was on a call, a second call was received. The second station will be a pay-per-call station the department will grow into, Platt said. This location is the best location for 50 years, Platt said. The next step is moving forward with a specific site. The city has identified a spot across the street from Centennial Park, but residents of the adjacent Harvest Estates neighborhood have raised concerns. Residents are worried about potential noise and additional activity and how they may affect property values, Heyer said. The city is keeping this site in mind, but also looking at other locations farther west on St. Andrews Drive, Heyer said. Platt said he understands residents' concerns and wants the department to be a community partner. He pointed to the main station's location near Penn Elementary School and a residential area. More than 40% of the department's calls are responded to without emergency lights and sirens, Platt said. I think we've been good neighbors for everybody, he said. And once a fire station is near a neighborhood, we're that much closer to your emergency, Platt said. Making Spirits Bright, Marion's Christmas in the Park features new LED tree. By Gage Miskeman. Marion is set to unveil its new Community Peace Tree on Friday during Christmas in the Park and the Peppermint Walk. Christmas in the Park will be from 4 to 8 p.m. in City Square Park. The tree is the biggest purchase the Marion Chamber's Leadership in Action class has ever raised funds for, coming in at around $70,000. The 30-foot LED panel tree will be the center of Uptown Marion's Park. The LED panel can be programmed to change colors, light patterns, and be synced to music. The tree replaces the city's original peace tree, a real tree that was gifted to the city in the 1990s during the Gulf War to symbolize a bright wish for a more peaceful world. The tree has become a main piece of the city's annual Christmas in the Park event, which began in 1993. Other smaller trees have taken its place over the last few years since the original tree died. Christmas in the Park is celebrating its 30th year this year. Santa and Mrs. Claus will arrive at 4 p.m., escorted by the Marion Fire and Police Departments. Children will be able to visit with the Mr. and Mrs. Claus and place letters in Santa's mailbox. In addition, attendees will be able to enjoy popcorn and cocoa, sing along to carols with the Heart of Marion Community Choir and School of Rock students throughout the night, and meet an alpaca. Donations of new hats, mittens, blankets, or socks are being accepted for the Keep Your Neighbors Warm campaign. Items can be dropped off at the caboose the night of the event or delivered to the Marion Chamber of Commerce office, 1070 7th Avenue, through December 9th. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, November 30th, 2022, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Cheryl Bartolini Clayman of Iowa City died peacefully at home on Sunday, November 27th, 2022. A celebration of life service will be held at 1 p.m. Sunday, December 4th at the Lodge at Terry Trueblood Recreation Area, 579 McAllister Boulevard. A family committal service was held at Oakland Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to Iowa City Hospice or the Iowa City Public Library Friends Foundation. Cheryl was born September 6, 1945, the daughter of Bruno and Anita Conley Bartolini. She grew up in Ladd, Illinois, graduated from Hall High School and Illinois State University, and received an MSW from Washington University. She married Jerry Clayman in 1971 in St. Louis. She had a long professional career in social work and also as a legal assistant. As a social worker, she facilitated adoptions, working in Illinois, Iowa, and Virginia, and was a social worker at St. Louis Children's Hospital. She was employed at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics for many years. She volunteered at the Iowa City Public Library and also served as a mediator in small claims court for more than 20 years. She volunteered for other organizations and served on commissions for Johnson County and the City of Iowa City. She was an enthusiastic amateur photographer and enjoyed visiting Door County. Online condolences may be shared at lensingfuneral.com. Dustin Anthony Andrew, 49, of Cedar Rapids, formerly of Blairstown, passed away unexpectedly in his home. Memorial service, 10 a.m. Saturday, December 3, 2022, at St. John's Catholic Church, Blairstown, with Father Craig Steimel officiating. Interment will be at Pleasant Hill Cemetery, Blairstown. Visitation, 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, December 2, 2022, at St. John's Catholic Church, Blairstown, with a rosary recited at 7 p.m. In lieu of flowers, a memorial fund has been established. Closter Funeral Home Marengo is assisting the family with arrangements. Dusty was born August 30, 1973. He is the son of Duane and Cindy Schmucker Andrew. In his youth, Dustin loved the outdoors, camping and fishing with his family. He enjoyed taking karate lessons, baseball, football, and was an exceptional wrestler. He graduated from Benton Community High School in 1992, where he wrestled and played football. He joined the Navy Reserves and studied construction mechanics. He worked as a carpenter most of his life, where he could enjoy his love for the outdoors. Online condolences at closterfuneralhome.com. Dwight Wesley Hansen, 73, of Bellevue, Wisconsin, was welcomed by the Lord to his heavenly home on Saturday, November 26, 2022, after a brave battle with leukemia. Dwight was born to John and Janet Malsbury Hansen on July 20, 1949, in Superior, Nebraska, the third of five children, and raised on his family's farm. He graduated from Superior High School and attended the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. During his freshman year, he met the love of his life, Janet Jo Harris. Dwight and Janet married on April 12, 1971, at St. Mark's United Methodist Church in Lincoln, Nebraska. Dwight earned his Bachelor of Science in Education Business in 1972, taught mathematics for 7th to 12th grade for a year in Brainerd, Nebraska, and earned his Master of Arts in Accounting in 1976 at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Dwight taught accounting at Iowa State University for 2 years and also earned his CPA and CMA during this time. He then joined the faculty of Coe College in Cedar Rapids, Iowa in 1978. Dwight retired from Coe as an associate professor of the Stead Department of Business Administration and Economics Emeritus in 2015. Funeral services will be held Sunday, December 4th, 2022, at 4 p.m. at Faith Lutheran Church, located at 2335 South Webster Avenue, Green Bay, Wisconsin, 54301. The visitation will take place at the church right before from 2 to 4 p.m. A meal at the church will follow. Dwight's burial will be Monday, December 5th, 2022 at 9 a.m. at Woodlawn Cemetery in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Cotter Funeral and Cremation Care, 860 North Webster Avenue, De Pere, Wisconsin, 54115, is assisting the family with arrangements. Alan May Martz, 94, of Homestead, passed away Saturday, November 26, 2022, at Colonial Manor. Funeral services, 10 a.m. Tuesday, December 6, 2022, at the Middle Amana Church with Elder Emily Hoppe officiating. Burial will be at the Homestead Cemetery, Homestead. Visitation, 4 to 6 p.m., Monday, December 5, 2022, at the Middle Amana Church. Memorials can be given in Ellen May's name to the Amana Church. Closter Funeral Home is assisting the family with arrangements. Ellen May was born September 24, 1928, in South Amana, the daughter of Ernest and Louisa Berger Leixenring. She graduated from Amana High School in 1947 and attended business college in Lamar's. She was united in marriage to Fritz R. Martz in an outdoor ceremony in Homestead, Iowa, on September 12, 1948. Ellen May was employed by Amana Refrigeration and Zuber's Restaurant. Alongside Fritz, Ellen May was a cemetery steward for the seven Amana cemeteries for 42 years. She was a member of the Amana Church. Ellen May will be remembered as strong and independent, albeit stubborn. She loved working in her garden and yard and quilting for family and friends. Online condolences at closterfuneralhome.com. Irma Fern Lyle, 95, of Tipton, Iowa, died November 28th from COVID while at Cedar Manor rehabbing from a fall. Irma was born on September 19, 1927, in Washington County, Iowa, the daughter of Roy and Mildred Fay Bauer Turnipseed. She graduated from Washington High School in 1945. Irma was united in marriage to James Lyle on May 23, 1948, whom she met on the dance floor and continued dancing with until his death in 1985. Her outgoing personality was perfect as she worked with her customers in the bank in Washington, Iowa, and later at the Tipton State Bank. She stayed connected to the customers as they had children and grandchildren. She was well known throughout her almost 70 years in Tipton, and was even the Grand Marshal of the 4th of July Parade one year. Visitation will be Thursday, December 1st, from 4 to 7 p.m. at Fry Funeral Home. Services will be Friday, December 2nd, at the First United Methodist Church, Tipton, at 10:30 a.m., immediately followed by burial at the Tipton Masonic Cemetery. Memorial contributions can be made to the First United Methodist Church, Tipton, Cedar Manor, or the Cedar County Senior Dining in Tipton. Grant Henry Takas, 78, died Monday, November 28, 2022, at his home in rural Walker. Massive Christian burial will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, December 3, 2022, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Urbana, with Reverend Jim Brockman as celebrant. Interment will be held at St. Mary's Catholic Cemetery in Urbana. The visitation will also be held at the church in Urbana from 4 to 7 p.m. on Friday. Phillips Funeral Home in Vinton is in charge of arrangements. Grant was born on May 27, 1944, in Cedar Rapids, the son of Nicholas and Edna Zeiser Takas, and graduated from Urbana High School with the class of 1962. Grant served his country with the United States Army during Vietnam. On October 14, 1967, he was united in marriage to Marilyn Abernathy in Vinton. Grant worked in maintenance at Rockwell Collins for over 20 years. He was a member of the Walter J. Meeks American Legion Post No. 264 in Urbana and served on the Urbana Volunteer Fire Department. He was a dedicated supporter of Camp Courageous. Grant was an accomplished woodworker and made very detailed replicas of his farm buildings. Grant and Marilyn also enjoyed fishing and camping with family. Online condolences may be left at phillipsfuneralhomes.com. Gregory Reed Beebe, of Cedar Rapids, born November 18, 1945, passed peacefully on November 24, 2022, surrounded by his family. Greg's most cherished roles were being a son, brother, husband, father, and grandfather. He was always surrounded by women, having four sisters and four daughters. Greg was a devoted husband, married to his love, Connie Bolton Beebe, for 52 years. They have nine grandchildren and seven great-grandchildren. Son of Mildred Eileen Brundage and Ellis Arlen Beebe, Greg was raised on a farm in Beebe Town, Iowa. He was a proud member of the American Legion after serving in the radar division of the Navy during Vietnam. He continued his career in aviation through retirement. Greg moved to Nebraska in 1966, living there until 1994, before moving to Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Greg taught those he loved many valuable lessons, to be hardworking, determined, and to never give up on their dreams. Friends and family knew him as having a heart of gold. Please feel free to join us for a celebration of life at the Red Lion on January 7th from 2 to 5 p.m. John Michael Horak of Cedar Rapids, age 73, passed away November 27, 2022, peacefully, with his wife Nancy and daughter Holly by his side. John was born in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, on January 2, 1949, to Milo and Anna Mae Horak. He graduated from Jefferson High School and went into business as Horak Motors and Autoland in Cedar Rapids. He moved his family to Florida in 1986 and became a well-known member of the used car community in Pinellas and Hillsborough counties. John is remembered for his vibrant personality and knowing no stranger. John's celebration of life will be held Saturday, December 3, 2022 at 2 p.m. at Curlew Hills Funeral Home in Palm Harbor, Florida. In lieu of flowers in John's honor, please make memorial donations to Moffitt Cancer Center. Velma L. Chamberlain, 94, of Olin, passed away on Sunday, November 27, 2022 at Bickford of Marion Assisted Living. Visitation will be held on Thursday, December 1, 2022 from 4 to 8 p.m. at Dawson Funeral Services in Olin. A private family graveside will take place at the Olin Cemetery. Velma Lorene was born on November 27, 1928 in Clarence, Iowa, to George and Tilly Harness. She graduated from Clarence High School. She was united in marriage to Gerald Frank Chamberlain on December 1, 1946 in Anamosa. She worked for Collins Radio for 10 years before becoming a stay-at-home wife to help on the farm and raise their six boys. She was a member of the United Methodist Church in Olin. Velma enjoyed playing cards, sewing, bingo, and spending her evenings on her porch swing, watching the sunset with her cherry slushies. Memorials may be directed to the family in her honor. Judith Judy Novak Allen of Iowa City died November 25, 2022 at Oak Knoll, Iowa City, Iowa, with her husband Eddie by her side. She was born in East St. Louis, Illinois, to Steve and Julia Novak. Judy studied dancing from the age of 3 1/2 and continued to dance throughout her life. She attended Catholic schools in East St. Louis through junior high school. Her family moved to Marshalltown, Iowa, where she graduated from St. Mary's High School. At St. Mary's, she was a cheerleader, prom queen, and choreographer for Amal and the Night Visitors. She attended Iowa State Teachers College for 1 year before transferring to the University of Oklahoma, where she earned her BFA in modern dance. Julie was active in all aspects of the modern dance movement. Judy then attended the University of North Carolina, Greensboro, where she continued her dance education, earning an MFA in modern dance. She was married at the Main Post Chapel at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, in 1970 to C.E. Eddie Allen, and they just celebrated their 52nd wedding anniversary this past June. In 1972, Judy accepted a position at the University of Iowa, where she began her 35-year span of teaching, choreographing, and administering dance in higher education. Starting as an instructor of modern dance in the Women's Physical Education Department, where she continued for 15 years, becoming U of Iowa's first full professor of dance. From the University of Iowa, Judy accepted a position at the University of Hawaii, Manoa, then to George Mason University, Fairfax, Virginia, and finally she became the department chair at California State University at Long Beach before retiring and returning to Iowa City. Memorial donations may be made to the University of Iowa's School of Music Percussion Ensemble, the Iowa City Johnson County Senior Center, the Cancer Center at the University of Iowa, or the Iowa City Hospice. A memorial service will be held at a later date and will be announced. The Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Service is attending the family. Website is gayandchia.com. Alfred L. Bobby Bryden, 84, of Hiawatha, passed away Friday, November 4, 2022, after a long battle with Alzheimer's. A memorial service will be held on Saturday, December 3, 2022, at 11 a.m. at the Community of Christ Church at 1500 Blairs Ferry Road, Hiawatha, preceded by a visitation at 10 a.m. The memorial service will be live-streamed at joyhopelovepeace.com. His ashes will be privately interred at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Memorials can be directed to the Oldorf Hospice House at 315 18th Avenue, Hiawatha, Iowa, 52233, or to the Community of Christ Youth Program, 1500 Blairs Ferry Road, Hiawatha, 52233. Online condolences may be directed to the family at cedarmemorial.com under obituaries. Virginia Ann Paul, 98, of Iowa City, Iowa, passed away November 28, 2022 at Briarwood Healthcare Center. Virginia was born on December 9, 1923 in Oxford, Iowa, to Ralph J. and Annis McDonough Dwyer. She graduated from Oxford High School in 1941, before attending Iowa City Commercial College. She worked at Nagel Lumber Company in Oxford and Iowa City until her marriage to Dale A. Paul on September 6, 1947 at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Oxford, Iowa. The couple moved to Maquoketa, Iowa, and then settled in Iowa City, where they raised their family. Virginia returned to work outside the home, working at Pepperidge Farm, Inc. and the University of Iowa, where she retired after 17 years in December of 1987. Virginia was a member of St. Mary's Catholic Church in Iowa City, Altar and Rosary Society, and Catholic Order of Foresters in Oxford. She was a volunteer at Mercy Hospital for many years, was a member of a sewing club, PMS club, and several bridge clubs. Virginia grew up in the era of big band and swing music and loved to dance. She always enjoyed spending time with her family and friends. Mass of Christian Burial will be celebrated on Monday, December 5th, 2022, at 10 a.m. at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Iowa City. Burial will follow at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Oxford. Visitation will be held on Sunday, December 4th, 2022, from 2 to 4 p.m. at Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to Essence of Life Hospice or St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. Wilford Joseph Becker, 93, of Newhall, passed away on Sunday, November 27, 2022, with his family by his side, after a short stay at Virginia Gay Care Center in Vinton. Funeral Mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, December 2, 2022, at St. Paul Catholic Church in Newhall, with Reverend James Miller officiating. Interment will be held at Holy Cross Cemetery, rural Keystone. Visitation will be held at the church from 4 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, December 1st. A memorial fund has been established. Wilford was born on the family farm near Newhall on January 16, 1929, to Arlo and Marie Anastasia Boddicker Becker. He attended school in Newhall and graduated from Newhall High School with the class of 1946. On September 19, 1950, he was united in marriage to the love of his life, Dorothy Brandt, at St. Paul's Catholic Church in Newhall. Wilford farmed for many years near Newhall and then Atkins. In the early 1960s, he was known for modernizing the dairy operation on his farm. During those same years, a Cedar Rapids Gazette article highlighted the farm's large flock of layer chickens. After retiring from farming and moving to Newhall in the late 1980s, he founded Becker Insurance Agency and went on to oversee a robust insurance business for 28 years. Wilford was an avid outdoorsman, enjoying hunting and fishing. He enjoyed spending hours at his cabin on the Cedar River near Vinton fishing. He provided food for many wild game feed fundraisers, as well as the family kitchen table. Wilford enjoyed gardening. He enjoyed growing flowers and had a room in the house basement with grow lights, as well as two small greenhouses. Geraniums were propagated year after year. Wilford enjoyed decorating his yard in Newhall for the holiday seasons, and he completed many carpentry projects. Online condolences may be left at phillipsfuneralhomes.com. That concludes today's obituaries. Moving to the editorial page, there is one letter to the editor today. It is from Mike Brogan of Cedar Rapids. The headline is Save Lives by Transporting Cancer Patients. Transportation to treatment is one of the biggest barriers for cancer patients. Many patients don't own a vehicle, can't afford gas, or don't have access to public transportation. Some may be elderly and unable to drive, too ill to drive, or have no family members or friends who can help with all their transportation needs. Without access to reliable transportation, cancer patients are unable to get regular treatment, and even the best treatment can't work if a patient can't get there. Every driver has what it takes to save lives. The American Cancer Society is urgently seeking volunteer drivers willing to drive cancer patients to their cancer-related treatment through the Road to Recovery program. To volunteer, all you need is a valid driver's license, a safe and reliable vehicle, and proof of insurance. Drivers must be at least 18 years old and have a good driving record. The American Cancer Society conducts criminal background and driving record checks on all drivers and provides free training. As a Road to Recovery volunteer driver, I can attest that the patients aren't the only ones to benefit from this program. It's a great feeling to know that I'm literally giving someone a ride that is helping to save their life. For more information or to volunteer, visit cancer.org/drive. That is a letter to the editor from Mike Brogan of Cedar Rapids. There is a syndicated columnist by syndicated columnist Sil Sobel today, and it is titled, I Shouldn't Have Doubted the Kids. Dear Millennials and Generation Zers, I'm sorry. I should have believed in you. Ever since I started writing children's books on civics more than 20 years ago, I've talked with you in schools, in libraries, and at book fairs. I've taken your questions about government and tried to answer them. I've known that you want to learn how government works and why. If something doesn't seem right or fair, you want to know why not and try to fix it. I watched you grow along with my own kids through high school and college. I've seen how you watch out for each other and care about each other. I've noticed that you don't have the same biases or hang-ups that many of us still have about race or gender or sexuality or nationality or religion or political party. I've seen that you value people for who they are, not for what they are or what they believe. I've watched you travel and explore and learn about other cultures and sometimes even adopt something they do because you like it and it makes sense to you. I've seen you show respect for each other and each other's beliefs. For years, when people told me they feared for our country's future, I always said I don't, because I had confidence in the next generation to do better than we did and to learn from and correct our mistakes. So I'm not sure why I lost my faith going into this past election. I don't know why I believed the pundits who said young people weren't going to vote in big numbers because they rarely have in the past. I don't know why I thought that important matters like personal freedom, education, gun safety, and civility and compromise in governance didn't matter to you. But you showed us. You proved the pollsters wrong. You turned out and voted, giving us the second highest showing for a midterm in your demographic in 30 years, according to estimates by the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement at Tufts University. You told us you were tired of extreme partisanship, that you wanted our elected leaders to do something for the people and not just for their parties. You told us you were sick of posturing and polarization and that you wanted action to improve people's lives. I think the best thing that could happen in this country is for aging baby boomers and Gen Xers to get out of the way and let the next generations take over. I believe we had good intentions, but somewhere along the way we mucked it up. We saw governance as a competitive sport and not as a public service. But if the November 8th election told us anything, it's that you get it. You see the mess and you're tired of it. You want the noise and contentiousness to stop. You don't want your personal freedoms to get tossed back and forth like a political football. You want common sense regulation to reduce gun violence. You want the education that's needed to fill important jobs to be available and affordable to everyone. You want us to stop destroying the planet, and you're tired of waiting for us to do it and are ready to take it over and do it yourselves. Good. Go for it. That is a syndicated column by Syl Sobel, who is listed as an author of children's books on U.S. history and civics. This was written originally for the Baltimore Sun. We now have a few minutes for sports. First item is Iowa's Padilla enters transfer portal. Backup quarterback moving on after appearing in just two games in 2022 by John Stepp. Quarterback Alex Padilla entered the transfer portal Tuesday as a graduate transfer. Padilla played in two football games for Iowa this season, completing 21 of 43 passes while throwing one touchdown and two interceptions. One appearance was after starter Spencer Petras had two interceptions and a fumble in one half, and the other was after Petras suffered an injury. Padilla's limited playing time was despite Petras struggling for much of the year. The fifth-year senior completed 50% or fewer of his passes in five games this season, but he started every game. Padilla released a statement on social media Tuesday saying he will cherish every moment and lesson from his 4 years at Iowa. I would like to thank the University of Iowa and my coaches, athletic staff, and Hawkeye fans for the support and the incredible journey, Padilla said in a tweet. Thank you to my teammates. Our bonds will last a lifetime. Iowa quarterback options for 2023 include Spencer Petras, if he uses his extra COVID-19 year of eligibility, or Joe Labas, who will be in his third year on campus. Petras completed about 56% of his passes in 2022 after completing 57% as the starter in 2020 and 2021. Labas has not seen game action yet. The alternative for the Hawkeyes would be to seek a quarterback in the transfer portal, although they have not aggressively pursued talent from there in recent years. Iowa was the least active Big Ten team in the transfer portal last year. And now to Iowa State basketball. Cyclones finding offensive balance. Iowa State hosts North Dakota today by Rob Gray. 5. That's how many different leading scorers number 23 Iowa State has leaned on while starting the season 5-1. That offensive diversity also helps explain how the Cyclones managed to mount a rally to upend then number 1 North Carolina in last weekend's Phil Knight Invitational in Portland before falling 81-63 to number 8 Connecticut in the prestigious event's championship finale. I think it just shows the type of guys that we have, said ISU's overall leading scorer, Jaron Holmes, whose team faces North Dakota, at 7 p.m. today at Hilton Coliseum. Everybody in that locker room is a winner. It showed throughout at Portland. Altogether, we didn't get the job done, but I think seeing everybody in that locker room after the game, it showed the love that we have for each other, how much we want to win, and how much we want to compete every single day. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, November 30th, 2022. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.